Welcome to the AI Business Podcast, where we feature conversations with interesting guests at the intersection of artificial intelligence and business.
Good morning. Welcome to the AI Business Podcast. My name is Mark Becchio. I'm Principal Analyst with Omdia. I cover AI, and I'm here today with Dr. Sam Samaras, who is the Head of Science and Technology for Unilever, Beauty and Wellbeing and Personal Care, and we're excited to talk a bit about what's going on with her and her team. So I'm going to start this by asking you to kind of introduce yourself, tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to your role today.
Sure. So hi, everyone. I'm Sam Samaras. I lead what we call science and technology across two of our business groups at Unilever, so beauty and well-being and personal care. And science and technology is a fancy name for upstream innovation. So what my team and I do is we work pulling the sort of external waves of science and technology going on in the world into Unilever and use them to understand different aspects of unmet consumer need. If you think about something like dandruff or something like dry skin, these are unmet consumer needs that people all over the world, no matter where you live, have. And so we work on how do we address those through using science and technology, either for new technologies, so the thing that goes in the product that makes it work, but also to make sure that we're able to address all consumers. So by understanding a consumer who lives in Shanghai, China, whose hair and skin type are very different than, say, mine, who lives in, you know, the rural New Jersey outside of Manhattan in the United States. So our climate is different. Our genetics are different. Our culture, meaning what's the norm for food, what's the norm for sleep, what's the norm for stress, are all different. And that all contributes to your overall well-being, which is driven a lot by the routines and products and services that you do every day. And we have a big piece of that. So that's kind of what my team does. I've been doing this sort of job, I'm afraid to say, almost 30 years. And I've done it across many different areas of research. I've worked in the pharmaceutical industry. I worked at Merck for about a decade doing natural product, antifungal, anti-infective drug discovery. I worked at J&J in their consumer health business, also for about a decade. Doing a very similar role to what I do here, which is, again, bringing science and technology across what their consumer business is. And now at Unilever across, they're all consumer, but across their part of the business that's associated with beauty and well-being and personal care. So my background is I have a bachelor's in biochemistry. I have a master's in biology, and I have a PhD in molecular biology and infectious disease. So deep core biologist back in the days when math wasn't a really big part of biology. So I've sort of had to learn that. And since we're talking about AI today, that's certainly now come full front for biology, but, it's been a learned skill on the job rather than something I was trained to do as a student.
That's interesting because it's always fun to talk to a full-on scientist. And then when you add that other piece that says I'm science and technology, that's always fun too. So you bring a very deep bench of science to the table. So that's interesting. Well, let's go a little deeper here and go, I think about research and development organizations are interesting organisms. When we talk to people and customers and different companies, very interesting organisms. They all seem different, run a little differently at different places. And it seems like what you're asked to do is pretty broad, right? It's deep and wide and all those things, big. So what does your team do and how do you prioritize focus areas and projects?
So the way Unilever is set up is sort of in a sort of discover, design, deploy kind of R&D organization. And I sit in the discover piece of it in science and technology. And so across the world, we have 6 global labs and about 5,000 R&D experts. But we work through the mechanism of always putting the consumer at the center of what we're doing, right? Because all the cool gadgets and all the cool technology we could invent, if it doesn't get into a product that a consumer wants to use, none of it matters, because it won't make an impact on that consumer's life. You know, as I said, I spent part of my career in pharmaceuticals. And, you know, in those areas, you know, if you have cancer or some sort of sickness, you take what the doctor tells you to take, even if it tastes terrible, even if it makes you feel temporarily worse while it's making you better. All of our products are products that you have to want to use. And so the way we choose what we're going to work on is all centered around bringing differentiated and superior products to our consumers. And there's a ton of science in that. If you think of the science behind the actual unmet need, like I mentioned at the beginning, of dry skin, or of no one wants smelly armpits, everyone wants to look their best, like doing a podcast with you. I wanted to make sure, how does my hair look? Do I feel confident? A big piece of that is how I look, and not from a artificial sort of way, but does it represent the true me as I'm speaking? Does it help support my psychological self as I'm speaking? So all of our decisions are made around the priority for that. Obviously, it comes to life in the brands that we have. And we have many, many very strong brands around the world, depending on where you go. Dove is probably the biggest that we have, that everyone would know who they are. But we also have a whole set of brands that we call local jewels that are as famous as Dove is in their own markets. And each of them means something to the consumer. And so the technology and science that we have to develop, it has to be congruent and drive the purpose of that brand as well. You know, if you think of Dove and their journey toward authentic beauty and confidence and true being there with your whole self, many of the ways that we communicate with consumers around science are about that. Or if you think about, there's a brand called Lux that is a big brand in Southeast Asia and India. And that's all about women and confidence and aspirational beauty as well. And so how we drive that as well. So everything comes from the consumer centric. And then we back up into how scientifically do we deliver that benefit? So we have people who, you know, know more about the sweat gland than anyone else in the world in the team. We have people who are the world's expert in polymer chemistry in a certain kind of format. Because not only do we need to make products that work and be able to prove that they work and talk about in a compelling way how they work, they also have to stay together and be shelf stable and be preserved and be safe and be all those things, which there's a huge amount of science. And then the final component with that is Unilever is a real leader in the area of sustainability and really wanting to make an impact to help our planet be able to support, you know, the ever-increasing longevity that we have. You know, people are living longer, which means the impact we have on the planet is longer. And so there's a lot of science that goes into being a net zero company or being a working on reducing our footprint from a climate point of view. And so we do a lot of work in that area as well. But again, it all has to end up in a compelling proposition for a consumer that brings that science and technology towards something that they care about. Because if A, they don't care about it, and B, it doesn't address their problem in a way that's pleasurable to use and enjoyable and they can see the results, we won't have an impact because no one will buy the product. So it's really important to us. We use AI across the business in many, many different ways and have been using it, as you said, for a long time. I think the first random forest model came out in the 1960s, I want to say. So it's not like this is new. But I think the two things that have changed in my area and the places that we research it is the compute power and the ability to structure metadata and put it in a place that's rational to then pull things together has really evolved in a way that you couldn't 10 years ago do. So if I think about one of the biggest opportunities in biology is you know, in the old days, quote unquote, of discovery, we would say, okay, there's, let's take people who, I'm going to use dandruff as an example, have dandruff and don't have dandruff. Let's take a sample. Let's look at the top 10 genes that go up and the top 10 genes that go down when comparing these two groups. And then you'd go like one by one, this gene, what does it do? This gene, what does it do? And really, biology is way more complex than that. And what really is happening is in this huge complex system, there's a tipping point, meaning that gene 375 changes by 0.2%, which then causes a change and causes a change. And that tipping point, we never, ever, ever, ever could have seen going through it in the top 10 up and downs. And what I think AI has really allowed us to do, combined with this plumbing, so to speak, of being able to access large data sets, we're able to now learn things that we could not learn before. So that combined with not only can we do it on one kind of data, we're now just at the advent of being able to pull multi-sets of data together. So your genetic data, your protein data, your inflammation data, we can now pull that all together. And by the way, we can start pulling in non-structured data. So data like consumer perception data or survey data or sales data, and start to put that together with these more structured data sets. And AI has allowed us to kind of, in non-technical terms, squish that all together and pull insights out and relationships that the human brain on its own just doesn't have the compute power to pull that together. And I think that's really what's, in my world, that's really what's changed in the last 5 to 10 years. We do and gather quite a lot of data. So for example, we have been investing in and working on the microbiome for quite some time. And actually, within the walls of Unilever, we have 3 times the data that the Human Microbiome Project itself has, because it's something we've invested in. So it's a large data repository that we build on every year through clinical studies, through, you know, we're doing a very large study in North America right now to understand polycultural America. If you representation of all skin types and all genetic types in the world is a problem, and is something that we in our little space are working to really, Unilever is a very large company based all over the world. So we serve consumers from everywhere. So we have a large data set that we do access and we do learn from that data. We also now using more sophisticated AI models beyond just the random forest, or, you know, we use models that can move us farther into predicting spaces maybe we don't have data in. And we do that, for example, in formulation space. So you know that a formula, so your shampoo that you used in the shower this morning is a colloid made up of 15, 20 different ingredients, all of which have a role in the structure of it, the feel of it, the performance of it, and the science of that formulation space is very specific. And so you can imagine how many experiments you'd have to do if you wanted to optimize 15 different components in a design of experiment. It's huge. What we can do with some of these newer AI models that can predict, if we pick the right spaces in that space, it can predict the places that we haven't filled in with experimental data, because it learns from the data that we are generating and it predicts that. So that's, we're doing that in multiple places. I do think there is quite a lot of buzz at the moment in this sort of prediction piece of AI, but the prediction is only ever as good as the data that you feed it surrounding the place that you want the prediction, right?
So glad you say that. I'm sorry to interrupt you. We get this all the time, and it's nice to talk to what I call adults in AI, people that are companies that are working on this. And it, you know, that comes up a lot lately because of all this buzz around generative AI. So let's just set that aside and talk about that for 2 seconds and say, you mentioned another piece about this, what you're doing with the data. And I think it's important for most people to understand the integrity of that data, right? And how you feel in the confidence of what you have, right? right? So you mentioned two pieces are structured and unstructured. Can you talk about your confidence and how you've grown that, you know, like how you manage your data over time to get the right kinds of data?
Yeah, and it's interesting. So, and my team always sort of laugh because, you know, it's what I call the plumbing, right? And I don't say that because I think the plumbing is less important. I think if you don't have the right plumbing and you don't have the right structure or even structure around unstructured data, if that makes sense, you can't use that data, right? You have to have the right metadata associated with it. You have to know where it came from. You have to know, for example, did I collect this data on Asian females between the age of 45 and 70, or did I collect this data on millennials in Mexico who are interested in hair straightening, for example? Those are just two consumer groups we might speak to about things. If I don't 5 years from now know that which group is which by my metadata, I can't use that data sensibly because I need to know the genesis from whence it came to be able to make any sort of conclusion. So we've put a lot of effort as a company and a lot of resource over the years into building the right plumbing, into secure data lakes where we keep our data, into partnerships with companies like the EBI in the UK, so the European Bioinformatics Institute, where we access data with them, and many, many other examples where, you know, there's internal data and there's external data, and both are valuable and really valuable when you put them together. You know, there's lots of great publications of new insights in data. And so we spend a lot of time not only thinking about the end result of the data, but making sure that the place we know that when we go back to the data, because we don't want to just use data as a one-off. It's a valuable, valuable resource that we want to continue to be able to go back because it builds our learning in a very generative way.
Don't say that word. You're going to get in trouble.
Not generative in the way you were speaking about generative AI, but in a generative way.
Okay. So I want to go back to another thing you said and talk about, you know, lots of companies are always interested. We hear this all the time, you know, that there's AI out there, there's AI out there, but you're talking about, you know, ROI a bit. You talked about a little bit about, you said, well, when we started to look through these pairs and stuff, it's, you had to do that. It was very, you know, extensive process. And now that you're able to speed that up, things happen. So I guess talk a little bit about what you're seeing for you in terms of ROI on what you're doing with AI. And can you translate that to what results we're getting?
Sure. I can give you a couple of examples if that'd be helpful. So we have a really great example with it's a prestige brand that we own in North America called Hourglass. And their whole purpose and reason for being is around vegan natural beauty. All of their products are that. However, lipstick, red lipstick is probably the cornerstone of a cosmetics brand. The red in red lipstick comes from something called red carmine, which is made from crushed beetles. It's very hard to be vegan if you're getting a pigment from crushed beetles. And in fact, there's about 1,000 crushed beetles in a lipstick. And that red is a very, very specific color, right? The depth of it, how it layers on the lips. The lips are have a very specific translucency based on the way the epidermis or the skin layers in the lips work. And so we used AI to really look across the whole chessboard of pigments, color. So color is LAB, so lightness, and then A and B are the tones in color. And we used a huge chessboard AI to really come up with a combination of natural vegan pigments that are equally as vibrant as red carmine. And using computational models, we were able to test new combinations of ingredients. It would have taken millions of physical experiments to replicate. And so using that, we identified the technology. It's rolled out in something called Hourglass Red Zero product. And it's, you know, that red carmine is in approximately 18% of all color cosmetics. And we were able to really move Hourglass forward in a way that's very congruent with who they are and what they're trying to bring to a consumer. And we'd still be doing the experiments today. And we'd be doing them another 5 years into the future if we had to do it without AI to be able to really get that the specificness of that pigment. So that's an example of something that, yeah, we could have done it without AI, but it would have taken us 5 years. And with it, it took us 18 months.
You know, in a kind of little follow-up to that question is, you know, many companies that are just getting into the space don't understand the investment and what, you know, how you get there, right? So it's not overnight. It's not something that happens immediately. I mean, in terms of where Unilever started, can you tell us how far back you were? You know, how long is this investment?
So I can give some examples. So I've been at Unilever 7 years and they were investing way before I got here. So in the area of science and technology, we've been investing in things like microbiome data for about 15 years and the AI associated with that. We've got great external partners. We work with, it was a small startup, now it's a pretty good sized startup called Eagle Genomics. And they really have helped us build those pipelines. So we don't always do it alone. There are some great subject matter experts out there who are building capability in these spaces, and it's much better to partner with, you know, we have amazing smart people within Unilever, but there's equally numbers and probably more amazingly smart people outside Unilever that we can work with and learn from. Obviously, we work with some of the larger guys in the space too, Microsoft and IBM, and, you know, accessing that sort of thing. If I think about beyond, you know, my little part of Unilever, if I think about supply chain, or I think about how we look at design and manufacturing processes through virtual simulating, twinning our manufacturing facilities. You know, we've got some really great lighthouse, fourth generation lighthouse manufacturing facilities around the world and have been a real leader in that space. I know less about it personally because it's not the part of the organization that I lead. But again, we've been leaning really hard into that by starting to build the capability. We've got a couple of advanced manufacturing centers, which are completely automated pilot plants. We've got one for bars. We're the world's largest soap bar producer. And soap manufacturing is an incredibly complex physical thing. And so being able to have a digital twin of how we scale that sort of thing up to go to our manufacturing centers all over the world is really important. We've been doing that for 15 years. So we've tried to advance at the same rate that the industry is, and the world of that is advancing. And in some ways we're leading the way, and in some ways we're fast followers, depending on specifically what you're talking about.
I have one more question, and I think I might have, if you have a little bit of time, I just want to ask this one. And to me, you know, you guys have bench strength here. Clearly we're talking about experience with AI. And I think it's interesting because we're finding a lot of folks are, like we said, just getting into this and they're experimenting and they don't quite understand the risks. So I wanted to ask you, what causes you to pause about AI if there's something that it's in your mind is something to be careful with?
I think there's probably, you know, in our, as we digitally transform Unilever, you know, we are definitely leaning into AI, machine learning and data. But what we're really leaning into is our talent and our people, who are the ones who are going to be using AI. And we have an incredibly strong opinion on the responsible, ethical, and fair use of data, right? Collecting data in line with, you know, values, obviously applicable laws. We operate in many, many countries around the world. And, you know, respect for privacy. You know, I also lead within Unilever clinicals. So all the human testing that we do on clinical studies, I also lead. And so we have many strong points of view on, you know, the ethical way to do that, the way we test products, the way we inform consent people. So all of that has to be in place, and that has to be in place by people. People who are experts in what they do, people who are really understand and are believe in the things that I just said. Once you have that, then increasing the use of AI, machine learning, and their tools, just like 20 years ago, taking a gene list and looking at the five that went down and the five that went up. It's a tool to be used. Now, they're amazing tools, and I'm very excited about where we can go with them. But my number one focus is on the right people within and talent within the organization and that we partner with to use those tools in the way that they're meant to be used. So that's probably how I approach it, is less about the what am I worried about in the tool itself, because the tool is a tool in someone's hands. And it's the talent that we recruit. It's the shared pursuit of doing it in a way that is all the great things it can be and minimizing the challenges. You know, I think one challenge is making sure that the data that you're using is representative of the question that you're trying to ask is something that I would worry about, for example.
Very interesting. You know, I'm kind of excited. One of the things we think about a lot is that there's a lot of promise in what you're doing in life sciences for AI, that AI has a real role to play in life sciences. So I'm looking forward to seeing what you do next. This will be, we'd love to talk more and see kind of what you guys are, what's under.
Yeah, no, I'd be more than happy to. I think, you know, I can talk more about life sciences because, as I said, I am a biologist. But I think in all areas, it is increasing. And I think it's this ability and availability of compute power that's really changing the game in terms of being able to compute large sets of data. I talked a little bit about colloid science and polymer chemistry. And, you know, we, you know, for example, have announced last year a collaboration with a biotech company called Genomatica, around creating fatty alcohol tails for surfactants. Obviously, we use a lot of surfactants across all of our businesses, or at least three of the five. And, you know, we need to move some of our base of surfactants to a non-dependent on palm space. And so that is an area that, you know, we've invested in biotech, and biotech is gene engineering bacteria to make what you need. And you use AI to do that. So that's a great example of pushing the envelope for an end benefit that will help us as a business, will help the planet, and will help us ultimately consumers as well.
Very good. Dr. Samaras, thank you so much for your time today. This is interesting. And like I said, looking forward to seeing what you
do. Thank you. It was really fun. I enjoy talking about it. So thank you for the great questions.
To get more AI news and insights, visit our website at aibusiness.com. Until next time, thank you for listening.